You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about a vaccine for Ebola that's being developed here in Wisconsin. First, BuzzFeed News reported last week that the dating hookup app Grindr has been sharing the HIV status of its users with third-party companies. The app is marketed largely to gay men, and users are given the option of sharing their HIV status as part of their profile. The company has 3.6 million users worldwide. Now, after a backlash from some of those users and privacy advocates, the company says it will stop giving that data to other companies. Grindr released a lengthy statement last week defending its data sharing practices, and last Thursday, the company's vice president of social impact apologized to users with a video on Twitter.
I want to start by apologizing from everyone here at the Grindr team for all of the distress that we've caused over the last 48 hours. I know that many of you have questions about what happens to the information that you put on your Grindr profile, and I'm going to try to answer some of those questions today. I want to say at the outset very clearly that we have never and would never sell any user data, especially HIV information, to advertisers or anyone else.
Ayako Miyashita Ochoa is an adjunct professor at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. She specializes in confidentiality issues for people living with HIV. Ayako, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, in this particular case, Grindr says it was sharing this information to optimize some of the app's features. It was sharing it with third-party companies that helped them. They said they were not selling the HIV status information to advertisers. Are there still issues, though, with privacy here?
I do think so, and I think that it's really an issue that's addressing a lot of people these days. With everything in the news that's happening on Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, I think people are just coming to an awareness now that the responsibility of defending your right to privacy is solely on your shoulders, and asking a private company to essentially take on that responsibility is a faulty strategy for maintaining your own privacy.
Can you talk about special privacy concerns for people living with HIV in particular?
Absolutely. I think the big issue with putting out personally identifying information along with a person's HIV positive status is problematic because there continues to be stigma surrounding HIV. And the way in which we know that that stigma manifests is certainly the criminalization of people living with HIV. I looked up the statistics and tried to understand what's happening in your neighborhood in Wisconsin, and there is record of several cases, albeit a little old, 2008, where a person who failed to disclose their HIV status was convicted of reckless endangerment that led to a penalty of 15 years imprisonment. So when you have criminalization as the backdrop, it is incredibly problematic that people are not aware of where their information is going and who that information is being shared with.
And part of the goal, as I understand it, of people, of users of Grindr sharing their HIV status with people they might meet online, there's a public health goal. Can you talk about the impact that can have?
Absolutely. I think that there is a public health goal, that data is being shared voluntarily helps to reduce stigma to the degree that people are increasing visibility around what it means to be a person living with HIV, and that doesn't necessarily mean what it used to mean when the epidemic first got started. This is helpful because there are a lot of interventions that can be implemented in that space. Right, HIV testing promotion, messaging about HIV, messaging about how to prevent a person from ever acquiring HIV. Those are good things. I think that what we're seeing now is just the need to be really careful. And I think that the public is learning through this experience that it's good to be a little wary. It's good to read the terms of use. It's good to know where your information is going. I also think that Grindr was a platform that was promoting these behaviors. And that was, and that is, it continues to be, to the extent that people are accepting of it, a good practice. The golden rule in public health is that people maintain personal responsibility for their own health. And obviously the golden rule around disclosure is that you do it, right? At the same time, as I said before, the world as we live in, the society as we live in, the reality is that people living with HIV are criminalized, stigmatized. They're still treated differently. I see that in the lives of my clients who call and let me know that, you know, it's really stigma related to HIV that led to a lack of services or a denial of services. So forcing disclosure or creating the conditions where you're eroding a person's privacy and disclosing HIV status through these other mechanisms is something that has to be carefully considered.
Is this disclosure about what Grindr had done until last week something that you think will deter people, will make people think twice before sharing their HIV status with people they might meet via Grindr?
I think so. I don't think that people are going to walk away from this not having been changed by this incident. The right to privacy is something that you have to proactively assert and or defend. And so to the extent that people are starting to realize when Grindr says, you know, what you make public on your profile is just public, period, that it means that. And I know that that's not something that people that have been using Grindr were aware of and or were practicing, sort of their disclosure around, that it would be something that was open to everybody, including these third parties.
Ayako Miyashita Ochoa is with us from the UCLA School of Public Affairs, talking about the disclosure last week that the hookup dating service Grindr had shared HIV status information of its users with third-party companies. They've since backed away from that. They won't do that anymore, they say. Ayako, I know it's an interest of yours to find ways to use technology and apps to help serve people with HIV, including, I think, an app to help remind people to take certain kinds of medications. Can you talk about the potential positive uses of online technology?
Absolutely. I mean, the CDC and our federal government has invested in creating some of these mobile apps where people can securely, again, that's the key term, share their information with the platform so that that platform can help with adherence. That's obviously a positive goal and a positive movement. You know, my colleague Ian Holloway and I are actually in the process of creating a mobile app ourselves, one that looks at providing social support for young, black, gay-identified men in Los Angeles. And one of the things that has consistently come back to us in the form of feedback is that these young men want to know that their information is private. They want to know that this is as anonymous as they need it to be. And I think that that's the real lesson to bring home here.
Right, because the concern can be not just what they use on an app, but the fact that they've downloaded an app targeted to this particular community in the first place. They would want that confidential, I imagine.
Absolutely. And so you have to think about it from that perspective from the beginning to the end, including what is the app named? What is it called? How does it look? What does it say on the outside? If you Google the name of the app, what comes up? It could be the most simplest of things that ends up leading to a disclosure. And so we are having to think about that from every angle.
I want to ask you a question from two different angles now about responsibility for privacy of our information. First, for someone who is HIV positive, what are your recommendations for them as they think about whether to disclose, where to disclose their HIV status online?
Well, I think disclosure is really just a continuum. And I think every individual living with HIV is in their own journey and has decided for themselves where they are in that spectrum, if you will. I think that the thing that I would say as a lawyer, someone who's focused on the rights of individuals, knowing what I know about the kind of discrimination that takes place, I would caution people from disclosing just to anyone. You know, disclosure happens in a lot of ways. It can happen, you know, in a church setting, in a workplace. It can happen over email. It can happen over Facebook. We've seen this happen with our clients who weren't really prepared to tell everyone in the world about their status. So one of the things that I do caution our clients is to really think through, to what extent is this information that you want to share and need to share? And those are two really separate things.
And flipping it around now for a company, whether it's a website like Grindr, whether it's the developer of an app like ones you're working on, what is the responsibility there for ensuring privacy and confidentiality?
I think it's transparency. And I think that's really what's thrown people for a loop here. That Grindr was a platform that people expected a certain amount of privacy from, and really it was learning that data, that information was passed on to third parties that I think the public just didn't agree to. Obviously, from a technology standpoint, we also know that sharing increases the risks of additional disclosures down the line. So every time you open up that gate and let that information through to another party, it's just increasing the probability that it could be disclosed elsewhere. So these are the kinds of things that I think we need to pay attention to and are important to focus on.
We'll leave it there for now. Ayako, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ayako Miyashita Ochoa is an adjunct professor at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. She's with us to talk about the same-sex dating app Grindr ending the practice now of sharing its users' HIV status with selected third-party companies. That practice came out into the open last week after a report from BuzzFeed. First, researchers at UW-Madison have been working to develop a vaccine for Ebola, the deadly virus that's claimed over 11,000 lives since a major outbreak in 2014, and their efforts could soon pay off. An experimental vaccine from UW was tested successfully on monkeys in 2015. Now, phase one clinical trials for humans are set to begin later this year. Alhaji Njai is a UW-Madison research fellow with the Department of Pathobiological Sciences and is working on this vaccine effort. He's also the founder of Project 1808, a nonprofit dedicated to building capacity for sustainable livelihood in Sierra Leone. He's here to tell us more about the vaccine and the process of developing it. Alhaji, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Before we get to this work on this new vaccine, let's talk about Ebola and the state of Ebola in Sierra Leone and other countries in Africa. We had that horrible outbreak a few years back. We haven't had that bad of news, but it hasn't gone away, I'm sure.
Yes. So far, Sierra Leone is free of Ebola as far as we know in terms of the human-to-human transmission. But we all know from the history of Ebola in Africa back in 1978 that when once it hits a region, there is a likelihood that it will come back. And so, you know, a lot of the work we are doing down there is to actually be on that sort of offensive or pro-fence to kind of begin to walk ahead, and not wait for another deadly outbreak like the one that caught us in 2013.
And you're from Sierra Leone. You've been there a lot in recent days, actually.
Yes, yes.
How has Ebola affected Sierra Leone?
Ebola impacted Sierra Leone. And actually, we just had elections in Sierra Leone. And part of the big issue around the elections was actually the Ebola, how either the government handled or mishandled the Ebola, and how thousands of people are still affected by Ebola. You have over 17,000 and beyond people who are survivors. But the whole country was impacted because the economy, everything was shut down because of the Ebola. And things are now just beginning to come back, to normalcy in parts of the country. But the lingering effect is still there of Ebola.
And let's talk about the virus itself. As I understand it, it isn't the fastest spreading virus. There are things that spread faster, more easily, but it's very deadly when it is transmitted.
It is. It's one of the most deadly viruses as far as we know of for human pathogens. And, it's very interesting with Ebola because somehow, for all other animals that Ebola infects other than us and the chimpanzees, they are okay. But for us humans, our immune system somehow just doesn't know what to do with Ebola, and we react so badly to Ebola. And so it tends to be a lot more deadly, and it kills for the good number of the cases when it infects humans.
And how did you get involved in this UW-Madison effort to develop an Ebola vaccine?
So I was working separately, trying to build a research program around Ebola, and also at the same time doing community health education and social mobilization in communities impacted by Ebola in Sierra Leone during the outbreak. And somehow I got an article written here about my effort along with Professor Yoshikawa, and so we got to meet, and Yoshikawa had been working on an Ebola vaccine for over from 1995, and so we decided to this was an opportunity, a unique opportunity to get access to human samples, to get to know more about Ebola. So that's how we came together as a team to kind of begin to work on this aspect of the vaccine.
Now, Ebola is a virus, so something like an antibiotic isn't going to work on it at all.
Yes.
Prevention can be hard. Is a vaccine, you think, a really promising way to deal with this disease?
Yes. Thought about, in 2013 to 2014 up to 2015, thousands of people dying, and there was nothing you can do. And if there was a vaccine at that moment, we could have saved lives. And so the vaccine is definitely, you know, one of the best route to in terms of finding a solution to Ebola. And we are very happy to have a candidate that is very promising from UW-Madison.
We're talking to Alhaji Njai with the UW-Madison Department of Pathological Sciences, founder of the group Project 1808, about the quest to develop an Ebola virus and some promising results in your effort, you and your colleagues working on this. How are you tackling this vaccine?
So one of the things is that for many of the vaccines out there, they've used a protein fragment either of the Ebola or another virus. What we've essentially done here from UW-Madison and the work with Yoshikawa is actually to knock out the gene, the VP30 gene, that is actually responsible for replication or attaching to human cells. And without the VP30 gene, the Ebola virus doesn't do anything. It doesn't replicate. It doesn't do much. So we have been able to create a Delta VP30 mutant of the virus. And because it is a whole Ebola virus that you are presenting to the immune system, you are able to prime the immune system better. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, if you are able to, the immune system is able to see much more of the entire virus, and then it's able to, develop, antibodies responses that are more appropriate.
So if I get these other vaccines that just have a bit of the protein, my immune system learns a little piece of the Ebola virus.
Right, right.
This way I'm getting all of it except the bit that says, hey, attack Rob and take root in him. So my immune system learns the whole shebang.
Exactly. So it's really primed for the whole thing. And so it can actually, develop the memory cells, be able to kind of, okay, well, next time you see the same thing, it's the same structure, the same thing, and it's able to actually develop the better biological response to it.
So where is this now in the testing process?
So right now, we've been able to move it along successfully, and now it's in the biomanufacturing phase, which is sort of creating GMP batches of the vaccine. So it moves from the lab phase to actually that manufacturing phase. So it's now here housed at the Weizmann Center at UW-Madison, where the Weizmann Center has very sophisticated technology to kind of develop biologics like this for many other vaccine candidates before. So we are producing 1,000 doses here, and then those 1,000 doses will be used for a phase 1 clinical trials, first in Japan, where we got funding to do this.
Now, is this virus meant to be something that once it's ready to go, it's tested, it's approved, then you go to Sierra Leone and other countries in the region and try to administer it to as many people as you can? Or is it, okay, it looks like we've got an outbreak in the works, then we do it?
I think the latter, because the way it works, if there is good results on the phase 1, we could technically go to a country like Sierra Leone for a phase 2 with enough funding. It all depends on the money around it and much more, because, and that's the reason why it's harder to do work on issues like Ebola, because, it's in a specific geographic area, specific populations where, pharmaceutical and other companies don't see a lot of profits coming from it. So all of this work requires lots and lots of funding. The other piece that you said is it could be shelved, and then when there is an outbreak, WHO can, look into the shelf and say, this is a promising candidate. We can go to this outbreak region with this, and that's where we think there's also a possibility of using it.
When I think of something like the flu virus, it's a moving target. It mutates. It changes. There are different strains floating around, and that makes it hard to develop the perfect vaccine. Is Ebola something like that, or is that a little more predictable?
I think in this case, it is a little more predictable because the Ebola has typically a smaller number of genes, and it does do some of the mutations that you'll find in the flu virus, but it is not, the levels of the change, the mutations that might happen may not be as faster as in the flu virus.
Best case, if testing went just right, safe, it looks like it's effective, how soon could these be ready to go on a assuming there's the funding, on a scale to really make a difference?
So we're looking at, say, in a phase one trial, say, in Japan in December. And so, you know, so hopefully, you know, if we can get that through on all the steps and all the stages by, you know, December. And so, and we get, you know, clinical trials done in December. So let's say maybe mid next year. So that could be a possibility.
That's fast in some ways in drug research time, but do you feel sometimes like you're racing against the clock for that next outbreak? Hopefully it's not around the corner.
Yeah, and I think that's the case. You know, I think the faster we can get some of these vaccine candidates up and closer to approval and, you know, getting them to work, I think it's very important because it's very unpredictable and you can't, you know, Ebola, an outbreak could happen today, it could happen tomorrow. And it's just, we just don't know, have enough information about the environmental conditions that precipitate an outbreak.
Alhaji, thanks so much for joining us today to share your research.
Thank you very much.
Alhaji Njai is a UW-Madison Research Fellow with the Department of Pathobiological Sciences. He joined us to talk about efforts at the UW to develop a successful vaccine for Ebola. Coming up, dozens of people are dead following a suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria this weekend. We'll talk to an international relations expert about the potential response from the United States and global leaders. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Now, a suspected gas attack was reported this weekend in the Syrian city of Douma. The attack left dozens of people dead, and medical organizations based there have said many of the victims were women and young children. The suspected chemical attack is one of the latest acts of violence in the ongoing Syrian civil war, which is now in its seventh year. And President Donald Trump is meeting with his advisors to determine how the U.S. should respond.
We are very concerned when a thing like that can happen. This is about humanity. We're talking about humanity. And it can't be allowed to happen.
The U.S. and its allies are pointing at Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime, Russian-backed regime, as the perpetrator of the alleged attack. Russia and Syria dispute the idea that it was a chemical weapons attack. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, you're following the story and the refugee situation there. What do we know about the chemical attack reported this weekend in Syria?
Well, it's a really grave humanitarian crisis. You know, we've seen at least 40 killed, and the reports, some of the earlier reports suggested the number was even higher, but certainly over 1,000, it looks like, have been injured. The evidence of the chemical weapons is largely coming from the medical relief groups that are on the ground. So some of the signs of the victims in terms of their eyes and the foam at the mouth, the bluish skin, you know, all of these things are linked with the use of chemical weapons, maybe a mixture of chlorine with some nerve agents. So I think at this point they're looking to do a full investigation through the United Nations and some independent groups to verify, but the earliest signs really seem to be pointing in the direction of a chemical attack.
What is the likelihood that this United Nations investigation would happen and that investigators would have full access to what they need?
Yeah, access to this part of Syria is really difficult. It's been hard for humanitarian organizations to get in. Right now, it seems like the Russians are leaning towards supporting this investigation, which would be significant. Perhaps it's sort of strategic to balance against the threat of an airstrike coming from the U.S. and the British and the French allies, which are also maybe hinting that they would support an airstrike. So it could be kind of strategically that the Russians are suggesting they would support an investigation, which would take a few days to then try and get in there and verify the use of chemical weapons, which would, in the process, you know, buy a little more time before potentially an airstrike would be conducted.
Now, we've seen grave humanitarian crises all over Syria. We've heard places like Homs and Aleppo over the years. Can you talk about Douma and why the focus is there right now?
Yeah, the focus is here because this is where we've seen this chemical weapons attack, and it's also where really the last stronghold of the rebel opposition forces that have been fighting against the Assad regime for over 6 years. This is kind of one of their last major territorial strongholds in the country of Syria. So in guessing that this, you know, or assuming, many are assuming that this probably was carried out by the Assad regime, it would sort of make sense that they would focus on this area that's, you know, one last strength of the opposition forces that they view as terrorists, which, of course, the opposition consider themselves to be trying to liberate the country from Assad's dictatorship.
Stepping back from this particular attack, even if chemical weapons had never entered the picture in Syria, this would still be a humanitarian disaster. Is that right?
Yes, it's a really grave situation. We've seen over 6 years of war, upwards of 400,000 have been killed since the conflict began in Syria in 2011. And with the number of people that need humanitarian assistance, the United Nations has that at over 13 million. And just the displaced, we're looking at about 6 million Syrians that are internally displaced. They've been driven from their homes in the country, but are still inside the borders of Syria. And about 5 million or so that are refugees, meaning that they have been able to at least get out of the borders of Syria, but many of them are in camps or temporary situations in limbo within the region.
Talking to Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, about the alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria over the weekend and the ongoing humanitarian crisis in that country and the U.S. response. I want to give another listen to President Trump calling out here suspected key players in the attack, supporters of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He demanded that other countries be able to investigate the attack. Here's what he had to say.
If they're innocent, why aren't they allowing people to go in and prove? Because, as you know, they're claiming they didn't make the attack. So if it's Russia, if it's Syria, if it's Iran, if it's all of them together, we'll figure it out and we'll know the answers quite soon.
Elise, let's talk a little bit about what the United States response could be. We've seen an airstrike from the Trump administration after a previous chemical weapons attack. There are some U.S. troops there, mostly in advisory roles in a lot of ways for selected rebel organizations. What do you see as the options for the United States here?
Well, it's tough. There aren't very many good military options. You're right. In terms of the U.S. troops, there are about 2,000 or so currently on the ground in Syria. Most of them are working to help the Kurdish-led SDF, which is the Syrian Democratic Forces, an alliance of Kurds and Arabs fighting against the Assad regime. And when we did launch a strike, you know, under President Trump, approximately 1 year ago, actually, it was April of 2017, when Trump launched the missile attack on the Syrian airbase. Similar situation. There was a chemical attack, you know, just before that. And so this was meant to show kind of symbolically and maybe even be a deterrent to show Assad that he better not do this again, right? So here we are a year later. It appears that the Assad regime has carried out yet another chemical weapons attack. And so the options aren't very good if the focus is on military use of force. You know, if we were just looking at a limited strike, it seems like we tried that a year ago, and that really didn't have much of an impact. The problem with a limited strike that may do something like take out a Syrian landing strip, you know, with an airbase, is the Russian allies that are there could rebuild that sort of thing very quickly. The danger of something more than a limited strike is that this escalates. And because it is no longer just a civil war, it has evolved at this point into a proxy war with the Russians involved. You know, Russia is a nuclear power, so there's a concern that anything more than a limited strike could escalate into a nuclear confrontation.
Now, current U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, spoke at a special session of the U.N. Security Council. She condemned the alleged chemical weapons attack and called on the U.N. to do something and issued a warning to the organization if they did not.
History will record this as the moment when the Security Council either discharged its duty or demonstrated its utter and complete failure to protect the people of Syria. Either way, the United States will respond.
Can you talk about the UN role in all of this, Elise?
Yeah, the United Nations is the primary way we have for the international community to try and address this sort of situation. There is this norm of a responsibility to protect when civilians are suffering mass human rights violations and war crimes at the hands of their own government. So this is exactly that kind of situation when we would hope that the organization would be able to give a platform for, you know, a global community of states to step forward and help protect Syrian civilians. The problem is, you know, we've seen a lot of resolutions that have gone through the United Nations since the start of the conflict. Many of those that have successfully passed through the Security Council have been for humanitarian aid access support, doing some kind of investigations or monitoring, maybe cross-border aid delivery, or calling for a ceasefire, something like that. And those resolutions have been able to make it through. The issue is any resolution where you start hinting at military intervention or something that would violate Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity as a country, this is when we've seen those resolutions blocked within the United Nations, especially by the Russian veto, because Russia has the veto power as a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, and also sometimes by China, because China is very concerned about infringements or violations of sovereignty to carry out regime change. They're sort of in principle opposed to that kind of military intervention. So that's the issue with the United Nations, is it's only as effective as its member states will allow it to be. And in this case, Russia and sometimes in the past China have prevented those kinds of efforts from moving forward.
We're talking to Elise Cohen right now. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She's with us to talk about the U.S. and international response to the latest alleged chemical gas attack in Syria. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you think the United States should be doing when it comes to the ongoing crisis in Syria? Should the U.S. be involved at all? Diplomacy, military intervention, airstrikes. What is your impression of U.S. foreign policy in Syria under the Obama and Trump administrations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about the suspected chemical gas attack in Syria this weekend and how the ongoing civil war in that country has impacted foreign policy here in the United States. Elise Cohen is with us, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on what happened in Syria this weekend over the last 7 years? What role would you like to see the United States play in trying to resolve the situation in Syria? And what about refugees? Does the United States have a role to play in helping them as well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Thanks for having me on. I'm not a big Donald Trump person, and I'm not a big one for military intervention. But I think what we're dealing is not just like some sort of foreign policy excessive action. We're dealing with war, you know, war crimes against civilians through the use of chemical weapons. And I think that a military response of some sort is necessary to state to the world that, you know, if you engage in this sort of conduct, you'll get a certain response. And I think it should be proportionate, but I'd be interested in your guest response. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. So the idea, at least, that, okay, maybe this doesn't, in the long run, as you were saying earlier, impair Syria's ability to deliver chemical weapons. It is a message saying, if you do this, something bad is going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that was the intent even a year ago. So your caller is right in terms of sending a symbolic statement, because we know that it isn't really going to have a long-term effect. I guess the question is if there might be something in terms of sending a message to having more than a unilateral strike, so that if we really saw a coalition conduct some sort of strike and also try and bolster support to the opposition so-called rebel forces on the ground. In this case, we see the British and the French appear to be having phone calls with President Trump that maybe they would coordinate something together. And if we can see even more countries involved in some kind of multinational coalition, that might also reaffirm that this is a message that, you know, nothing will, I guess, we won't do nothing, you know, if we see this level of violation of international norms and international law.
Thanks for your call. Go next to Dan on the line in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Howdy. Yeah, I don't know if America has that much credibility to be involved in that. Number one, the expense to do what they want to do, whatever they want to do. They don't even give lip service to the hundreds of thousands of people that are refugees in them camps and stuff, mostly young children and elderly people dying by the thousands. You know, and somehow, you know, some people, and first of all, there hasn't even been an investigation, a real investigation on if this is taking place and who benefits from it in the long run. And you know, in Parliament over in Britain, the United States and Britain had to admit to using white phosphorus. They call it whiskey pee.
I'm going to jump in, Dan. I got a lot there. Dan brought up the refugee issue, Elise, and we've talked about that some before. Can you talk about how many refugees there are in Syria internally and around the world and the situations they're in?
Yes, the refugee crisis for the Syrians is one of the worst refugee crises that we've seen since World War II. So we're talking about 13.5 million displaced people, which means people that have been forcibly driven from their homes because of the violence, because they fear for their life and safety. And so that's what makes someone a forced migrant or a displaced person. To be a refugee, under international law, you have to be outside the borders of your home country. And so out of that 13.5 million displaced Syrians, we see about 5 million are refugees. And so a lot of them, I would say, at this point, we're talking about the majority, the overwhelming majority of those 5 million are in the Middle East. They're being hosted primarily by Turkey, which has over 3 million Syrian refugees. Then we also see, even though Lebanon is a very tiny country, right now it's something like one out of every four inhabitants of Lebanon is a Syrian refugee because they've taken in so many relative to their tiny population. Jordan is another country that has been hosting a lot of Syrian refugees and has refugee camps. And the conditions in a lot of the camps are quite dire. So it really is a humanitarian crisis and a displacement crisis. But we have to remember that within Syria, we see about 6 million internally displaced, and they're really not able to access the support or help or asylum, you know, that could come with the protections of being a refugee outside of those borders. So that's an especially tragic aspect, is for those Syrians that they're still trapped inside the country in all of this fighting and don't have the resources or somehow, you know, have been prevented from being able to leave.
Elise Cohen is with us, political scientist at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, looking at the latest news and the humanitarian situation in Syria and a possible U.S. and international response to alleged chemical weapons attacks there. Back to your calls. Erica is with us in Lake Tomahawk. Erica, hi.
Well, hey. I just think that if they're going to do this again, they need to follow through. They bombed the bejeebers out of these people a year ago. It doesn't seem to have kicked in. If they're going to, they need to have a plan, not just drive a boat over there and blow up a bunch of Tomahawk missiles. They need to do something. I don't, beyond that, hurt somebody important. I don't know.
Thanks for the call. Elise, you mentioned the difficulties, the limited military options. Is that kind of planning, do you think, happening if there is some kind of military strike?
Yes, I'm sure that there's some plans. And again, this is something that those carrying out the strikes, like President Trump and the Trump administration, or even if we look at Theresa May, you know, in the British administration, they will have their domestic audiences within their countries. So this may be something that Americans like, or that the British or, you know, the French domestic public like to see, that their government is taking a stand and is you know, drawing that red line and saying, okay, we are going to give you consequences since you violated something in such a horrible manner. But the problem is really long term. We have to think about all the different parties that are involved in this proxy war. And so the Russians are really key here because for the Russian alliance with the Syrian regime, this is not just about ending the war. So you hear the U.S. and the United Nations focus so much on ending the war in Syria. For the Syrian regime, of course, but also for the Russians, this is really about winning the war, not just ending the war, because they have so much to gain. You know, for Assad, this is his own personal survival and what he believes is the national survival of his country. And for the Russian regime, we see also strategic military interests. There is a Russian naval base that is in Syria that potentially in the future could help house some of the Russian warships that are nuclear armed. There is also an air base that used to be regulated just with a bilateral treaty. It seems like now it's going to become part of a permanent military base for Russia in the Middle East. So when we start thinking about all these different actors and more long-term, I think that's when we need to engage some more difficult questions beyond just a limited strike, but really how this is a broader tension between the U.S. and Russia, between Iran and Israel, and between the Sunni and the Shia political powers in the Middle East.
That is super complicated, plus ISIS, a variety of rebel groups sometimes fighting against each other, as well as the Assad regime. How does someone start to untangle that anytime soon?
Yeah, you're right. It is really complicated. And I think that's part of the reason that we see these sort of simplistic answers or solutions being put forward, because it's hard to explain even to the American people what more complicated options would look like when it's difficult to even explain all of these different parties involved. You're absolutely right. It has been complicated by ISIS and militant groups being part of the chaos or the unknown elements that are armed and fighting. And then what we see is that political actors will take advantage of that, right? And so for Assad, he will say, well, all of those opposition are terrorists. You know, there's no moderate opposition. They're all like the Al-Qaeda's or the ISIS. And the Russian regime has said similar things. And part of the reason they've blocked United Nations resolutions is they've said, well, it's unbalanced because they're ignoring all of the terrorists that are, launching strikes against the regime. So I think the first level is to understand that it really is much more than a civil war. I think it still gets called a civil war a lot because the domestic actors are fighting each other over political power. But it really is a proxy war. This is U.S. and Russia.
And we'll leave it there. Elise Cohen, thanks for joining us. Elise is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, looking at the latest in Syria.